glad you've got your WBAI. Become a member online at WBAI.org.
And you're listening to radio station WBAI in New York, where the time is just about 7 o'clock. And, of course, that means all the chaos and confusion that it's time once again for, yes, Off the Hook.
The telephone keeps ringing, so I ripped it off the wall. I cut myself while shaving, now I can't make a call. We couldn't get much worse.
Very good evening to everybody. The program is Off the Hook. Emmanuel Goldstein here with you on this Wednesday evening, joined tonight by Mike.
Hi.
Rob T. Firefly.
Good evening.
Kyle.
Hello, everyone.
About a mile away from a microphone. And on the telephone tonight, I just found out, is Bernie S.
Greetings from Philadelphia. I'm sorry, the Comrex box is apparently locked in the closet and disconnected.
Well, whose idea was that?
I don't know. It needs to come out of the closet.
Yeah, I'll say. Okay. You know, it's amazing. We've been in town literally a block away for the last couple of hours. And even with that, you'd think we'd get here and have a nice relaxing time. But no, we're throwing things together at the last possible minute because we're always busy. We're always doing something else and adding to our huge list of things that we carry around with us. But you know what? It's fun. It's what we love doing. And I wouldn't have it any other way. Hey, joining us on the phone right now at this moment is Edward Snowden's lawyer, Ben Wisner. Ben, are you with us?
Yes, it's actually Wisner. I'm here. Glad
oh,
to
I'm
be
sorry.
Here.
Oh, okay. Well, I just learned
this
something.
Is what
Ben
happens
Wisner.
When people communicate only by email. They
I know. Isn't that something? We've never actually said each other's last names to each other in person. So
it's true, but there's so many of you, I can't tell if this is a radio show or a jury trial.
Well, maybe it's good practice. I don't know. Well, tell me, Ben Wisner, you spoke at Hope Number 9 back in 2012, and of course that was before the whole Ed Snowden thing happened. How did you manage to become the main representative for him?
Don't think I don't ask myself that question all the time. I did not know his name before you did. I first saw him and learned who he was when The Guardian posted that video that Laura Poitras shot of Glenn Greenwald interviewing him in Hong Kong in the Mira Hotel. I did, however, before that, know that he existed because I have both professionally and personally known Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras for quite some time. So I knew that they had been in touch with a source who claimed to be a high-level intelligence official with all kinds of interesting information. I knew that they were traveling to Hong Kong to meet this person. And you know, when he found himself, Snowden, stuck in the transit zone in the airport in Moscow, Glenn and Laura put me in touch with him because they realized that he was likely to need all kinds of legal assistance. That was in July of last year, just about a year ago this week.
It seems like so much longer because so much has happened in that 1 year.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes I think it's gone by in a blink, and other times, yeah, I feel like an old man. It's true. I mean, I've been doing this work since, I started at the ACLU a month before 9/11. So it's been, quite an arc of seeing how the country overreacted to those attacks.
Wait, you started working at the ACLU here the month before 9/11?
In August of 2001.
Wow.
So this has really defined my whole career here, working on issues related to national security, torture, rendition, Guantanamo, black sites, surveillance, watch lists. And I have to say that after doing it for about 10 years, I really felt like I had hit a wall. The fact that 10 years after those attacks, the country still hadn't found a different way to talk about terrorism, to contextualize it. We're still treating it like an existential threat that required us to dispense with our values and change our legal system. It was so frustrating to me that I really thought I need to do something else. And I have to say that the year of Snowden has injected so much energy and enthusiasm into our work, that this wall that we felt that was in our way has really crumbled. And it's not just because in technical terms, the documents that he gave to journalists have given us legal standing to challenge some of these programs in court for the first time, although they have. It's really that, you sense that the whole debate is different, that no longer are people willing to just listen to senior government officials say, trust us. They're trying to hurt you, and we're protecting you, and you need to trust us. That infamous clip of James Clapper, the director of national intelligence, just blatantly lying under oath in a hearing in Congress, I think has done so much to erode, rightly so, the credibility of the security state. And that, coupled with all of this documentary evidence that shows that the government wasn't just concealing its actions from us, it was misleading us about what it was doing, has given us this opportunity, I think, to reverse what had really been, seemed like just a one-way trend away from liberty and towards a security state.
It's incredible hearing this and realizing how the conversation has changed in such a short period of time, because when this first happened a year ago, a lot of people were kind of skeptical as to Snowden's claims. And then you saw things like Clapper lying blatantly. You saw all the revelations coming out, and there seems to be no shortage of the amount of surveillance that we and people overseas are subjected to on behalf of the NSA, on behalf of corporate America, on behalf of so many entities. And it's just, it's almost unbelievable. When I first saw Ed Snowden speaking, I was amazed by how cool and collected he was, how he basically was standing there facing up to all of this evil and being very stoic about it. And I just, it was just, to me, the best possible person to do this, to stand up and challenge and do it in an articulate way, a non-jingoistic way. And I hope that that's appreciated by a lot of people.
I hope so, too. I think you're right. It's hard to imagine someone more level-headed, clear-headed, at the same time, modest and idealistic. You can't really consider yourself just an ordinary person and be willing to do what he did, to give up your entire life, to put yourself on a plane to Hong Kong without knowing what the future holds. He must on some level understand that he's an extraordinary person, even though he insists that he isn't. But really, I've been impressed at every turn by how committed he is to principle, how he puts reform ahead of himself, and how willing he is to learn. Remember, this is someone who wasn't exactly able to consult with lawyers before he'd made any of these decisions. He really had to do all of his strategic planning on his own, and that now he finds himself going from real obscurity to being a global icon overnight, and has had to learn a lot. Has had to learn a lot about how the political system works, about how the media operates, about how the legal system, you know, might work for or against him. And he's really, really absorbed all of it. And you can actually, I think, see it. He was impressive when we first heard him speak in June of last year. But I think he's even more impressive when he speaks now. And not to steal your thunder, but, you know, he will be speaking at Hope 11.
You know, I forgot to mention that. Hope X, actually.
On Hope 10. X. Okay.
Yeah, a person at Hope 11, I hope.
Maybe.
Yeah, that's right.
That would be awesome, unless maybe we have to go to Russia to present that one.
Knock on wood. But Hope X, he will be there, what is it, on the 19th that he'll be speaking?
The 19th on Saturday. Actually, it'll be a conversation with Daniel Ellsberg. And that, you know, if I wasn't one of the coordinators of this, I would really want to go to that, to see these two heroes of America speaking together. Daniel Ellsberg, of course, responsible for the Pentagon Papers and changing the conversation about the Vietnam War way back in the 70s. And Edward Snowden, of course, doing monumental things, changing the conversation about surveillance, our privacy, things like that. And just
that's right. And I can tell you and your listeners now that this won't be their first conversation, that that over the course of the last year, facilitated by some of us, they've been able to have a series of encrypted chats, and those discussions have been just extraordinary. As these two people who were deep mutual admirers, you know, got to know each other over this intimate and sometimes awkward format. And you know, they now both serve as board members for the Freedom of the Press Foundation. So Snowden has appeared by Google Hangout at board meetings. So these two know each other, you know, fairly well by now, and I think it should be really a great, great event to see them speak together in public.
And the Freedom of the Press Association, I believe, Bernie, correct me if I'm wrong, they will have a vendor table and people can contribute to them?
That's right. The Freedom of the Press Foundation, which Daniel Ellsberg co-founded, will have a vendor table at HopeX, and so will the ACLU, which Ben was kind enough to find some paralegals to to staff.
Actually, so, it was Bernie X who was kind enough to give us passes so that we could be there. But yes, the ACLU will be there at a vendor table, and I hope that people will come and talk to us and will join. And then, you know, the ACLU has two computer scientists, technologists on our staff, Krista Goyen, who is known to some of you, and Daniel Kahn Gilmore. Both of them will be giving solo talks on Friday and Sunday, I think, at HopeX. So the ACLU will be a big presence, too.
If you want more information about the conference, hope.net, H-O-P-E.net, takes place Hotel Pennsylvania, July 18th through the 20th, right here in New York City. Mike?
I'm a bit unclear as to your implication that Daniel is not known to us. He is, and we're excited to have him speak as well.
Yeah, no, he's absolutely superb. I have to say that when I took over the ACLU Speech Privacy and Technology Project, which is a new project here, the first hire that I made was Krista Goyen. And having a project that mixes lawyers with computer scientists and engineers, technologists, it's so exciting to have these people in a room together. It both makes our litigation responses more sophisticated and more technologically savvy. But also they're able to bring to us issues that we might not have been able to identify as civil liberties issues. I mean, if you had tried to talk to me 2 years ago about the global trade in zero-day vulnerabilities, my eyes would have glazed over. And you know, now I think that that's an issue that even some of the broader public is getting to see as a result of some of the Snowden revelations. So we're very proud to be able to show up at a conference like HOPE, you know, with people who fit right in that community.
Well, Ben, let me ask you something, because I'm sure it's on everybody's minds. You're in touch with Edward Snowden on a fairly regular basis. How is he holding up under all of this pressure and attention and just being basically kept out of his country, kept away from the people that he knows and loves?
Yeah, I don't know how he does it. I think part of it, though, is that, remember, this isn't somebody who, before he left for Hong Kong and now Moscow, was, you know, exactly embedded in a community of family and friends. This is someone who had spent the better part of a decade already in the intelligence community, often undercover, in places like Geneva, Japan, elsewhere. So he wasn't someone who was, you know, so accustomed to being, you know, extremely social or even regularly with family. I think in some ways he is, you know, more socially connected now that he is a public person and is in touch with journalists, lawyers, activists, and other supporters regularly. Now, there's no question that it's painful for him to be separated from family. And, you know, I'm glad to say that some family members have been able to go over and visit him. And, you know, the lawyers go over and visit, and some journalists have been over to visit. So so he's not sitting, you know, alone all the time. And, you know, he also is someone who I think feels very connected online to people. And, you know, I was struck when I went to see him last January. You know, I thought, given my experiences of interacting with people, that it would be a profoundly different experience to be with him in the flesh after we had largely been chatting for all these months. But actually, it was more a continuation of that. He really is himself online, and I hope that people, you know, take some heart. You know, this isn't somebody who is living in a cold and lonely exile. This is someone who is very, very engaged with the debate that's going on around the world, very much in contact with people, with friends, family, and supporters, and someone whose, you know, morale is very, very high, you know, given the fact that the impact of what he did is, you know, can already be seen, I think, around the world.
It's interesting. We saw a guy over at the hotel earlier today when we were setting some things up. And his reaction to the news that Edward Snowden would be at the conference was that he wanted to stand up and boo him and say that he's learned things that he doesn't want to know.
Or that he might be forced to if he was to go and watch the talk. And we found ourselves sort of reminding him that our event attracts all kinds of different people and that he might get more out of it than he thinks at a first glance.
And one of the things, and I've heard this many times, is that, well, this guy went over to Russia and is giving away all of our secrets. You must be confronted with all kinds of misrepresentations as to what Ed Snowden has actually been doing. And how do you counter this for, say, some people listening now who think of Ed Snowden as a traitor, as somebody who's giving away secrets, telling us things that we don't need to know about, things that if we're not doing anything suspicious, we shouldn't be concerned, we have nothing to hide? What do you say to people like that?
I mean, I think there's a lot embedded in that. And I think that at the end of the day, his actions are going to have to speak for themselves. I mean, there are people, and I'm one of them, who are out there, you know, defending and explaining. But you know, there are people who will never be persuaded. If someone says to you, you're a liar, and you say, no, I'm not, I'm telling the truth, that's not exactly a persuasive rebuttal. They'll just think you're lying. And the same is true. You know, you're a spy. Well, no, I'm not. You know, I will say this. You know, I think one of the very common misperceptions about Snowden is that he, you know, dumped a huge amount of information on the public. Now, the number of documents that he has released to the public is actually zero. What he did is that he gave information that should not have been concealed from the public in the first place, for the most part, to excellent journalists with the instructions that they and their editors, in consultation where appropriate with governments, should make a decision in the public interest about what should be published and what should not be published. And every single thing that we've learned in the last year, we've learned because the Washington Post or the New York Times or the Guardian or First Look or The Intercept or one of these publications has made the determination that the public had a right to know what they were publishing. Now, maybe there are some people who think that they were better off not knowing these things. I think that's a hard argument to make. You know, I think that most people recognize that the amount of information that is withheld from the public is grossly inappropriate. That the vast majority of information that is classified is not classified for national security reasons, but really for reasons of protecting prerogatives and avoiding accountability and even just bureaucratic laziness. You know, I can tell you unequivocally, as he has said many times, he hasn't cooperated with any government other than the United States. He traveled to Hong Kong because he wanted to be sure that he could meet safely with journalists without being, you know, frankly, disappeared if he were in a place where the U.S. and its allies had more influence. He is in Russia because he wasn't able to continue on on his trip to Ecuador because he had no passport and was stopped. And now he's there because there is no other country where he can safely travel to and be. It's not where he would prefer to be. But again, you know, as much as there are people who will never accept that he's something other than a traitor, I do think that the level of public support that he has is also remarkable. You know, in January of this year, the most important newspaper in the world, the New York Times, essentially said that he should be given amnesty. you know, there are people who are running for president in 2016 who have discussed whether he should be given amnesty. This is a question that politicians are asked. And even though most of them say no, it's a reflection of how valuable the information is that he shared, that this is even something that senior politicians even have to answer.
So you've seen a change in public opinion over the last year?
Undoubtedly. And again, it's still divided in the United States. You know, there's still a significant portion of the public that you know, that doesn't see him as someone who acted in the public interest, but there's a larger share that sees him the other way, and then there are people who are in the middle, as with so many issues. But I also think that we need to look at how he's viewed in the rest of the world, where his status as a hero is really entrenched, and I think that by now, the United States government must recognize that the worst thing they could do for their, you know, reputation abroad and diplomacy with young people around the world would be to put Edward Snowden on trial. I think that quietly they probably say to themselves that they would rather have him where he is than in a courtroom in America, where around the world it would be viewed as prosecuting a truth teller and a human rights activist.
Well, now, okay, as far as what the United States government has done with regard to Ed Snowden, where does that stand? Have they filed official charges against
him? They have. That was back in June of 2013. They put out a charge sheet with three charges under the Espionage Act of 1917. Now, those three charges, each one could carry a 10-year sentence. But remember that at this point, they could add hundreds of charges. They could add an additional charge for each document that has been not just published, but handed over to journalists. So, you know, there's no question that if he were here in a court, he would be facing a sentence of life in prison. He would be held in isolation. He would be subjected to what are called special administrative measures that would limit his interactions with even his counsel and certainly with the press. So you would not have Edward Snowden participating in the debate that he helped to launch.
So that might explain.
I have a question for you.
Bernie, that might explain, though, why he doesn't want to just come back and face the charges.
Well, I think that's
suggest.
Right. I mean, let me explain that in a little bit more detail, but not a lot more.
And then, Bernie, you go ahead after that.
Yeah. So basically, these charges under a 100-year-old espionage law don't distinguish between giving information to the press and the public in the public interest and selling secrets to an enemy of the country. It treats those things in the same way. It's not relevant in a prosecution under the Espionage Act that, for example, these disclosures led to a historic global debate, that they've already led to changes in U.S. law, that the president has already ended one of the programs, that Congress is engaged in the first sweeping intelligence reform debate since the 1970s, that courts have declared some of these programs unconstitutional. All of that is irrelevant. The only thing that the government would have to show is that this information was so-called national defense information, that he knew it was, and that he gave it to people who were not authorized to receive it. There's no opportunity for him to say, this should not have been withheld in the first place, and its publication has done enormous good and no harm. It's basically strict liability. And that's why I think that he made the right choice to go to the airport instead of to a lawyer's office.
Go ahead, Bernie.
Well, basically, when you answered my question, Ben, I was just going to say, why wouldn't, as our Secretary of State John Kerry says,
man up,
just come back, man up, and come face the music? Or was it Clinton? Hillary Clinton said face. Somebody said face the music. He wouldn't. He, frankly, from a legal standpoint, he literally would not be able to, not be legally permitted to present a defense.
A public interest defense. That's exactly right. I mean, I think ultimately the question is, what do you think should happen to someone who did what Snowden did? if you think that he should go to prison for a very, very long time and perhaps the rest of his life, then you say he should come back and face the music. That's what the music is. The music is a life in a maximum security facility. If you think that he should be treated leniently or should be, as I believe, praised rather than punished for the role that he's played in helping to reform our democracy, then you don't think that he should come back and face the music. You know, I think that there are people who, you know, have this notion that, you know, he could come back and, you know, 12 jurors would hear him out and decide if what he did was justified or not, and then they would get together in a room and come up with what they think is the right punishment. That's not how the legal system works, and it's not how it would work in his case. All of the debate that we're having about whether what he did was justified or not would be irrelevant in a trial under the Espionage Act.
Well, I'm normally not in favor of ticker tape parades. I think they're a waste of money. But if anyone is deserving of one, it's Edward Snowden. And I hope I live to see the day when he gets one in this country, when people actually realize the hero that he is. Ben, have you seen any kind of backtracking on behalf of the Obama administration as far as, well, maybe we shouldn't be so hard on him, maybe listen to what he has to say, maybe give him some kind of way out of this?
I'm not going to go into any of the details of conversations that have taken place with the government for obvious reasons. You know, I will say that I think that there are differences of opinion within the government and within various agencies in the government about whether the principal posture of the country towards him should be one of criminal punishment or whether the principal posture should be how can we work together. How can he, you know, return to being a helpful asset to the U.S. and not just someone who's being pursued? But it may be that that day is a longer way off. We'll just have to see. I do think that every month that goes by, and certainly every year that goes by, the idea of putting him on trial for a felony and locking him away in a prison will come to seem more and more absurd. Right now, across the political spectrum, people view Daniel Ellsberg as a hero and an icon. But really, what separates Daniel Ellsberg and Edward Snowden is time. At the time of the Pentagon Papers, the leak, the attacks on him were just as vituperative. There were people who accused him of having dropped off the Pentagon Papers at the Soviet embassy. He was called a traitor. He was called a spy. The Nixon administration used dirty tricks against him. They broke into a psychiatrist's office. They tried to discredit him. Now, he has this sort of halo over his head. if there's a difference between Snowden and Ellsberg would be the first person to say this, it's that Snowden's disclosures have been much more consequential. They didn't come two-thirds of the way into a failed war. You know, they came at a time when it's not too late for us to do to implement genuine and deep reforms and to reverse a very disturbing direction, in the sort of creeping towards a surveillance state. So, already in the last year, we've seen changes by technology companies, we've seen changes by governments, and I think we're still at the beginning of this debate. So I really believe that there will be a time when, again, the idea that what Snowden did was heroic will be much more mainstream than it is right now. But it might take us a while to get there.
Ben, I wanted to point out that we have another whistleblower coming to a renowned whistleblower coming to HOPE-X, and that is Thomas Drake, who is the first whistleblower to be prosecuted for espionage since Daniel Ellsberg. And of course, you've been in touch with your client.
Well, that's right. He was over there as well. They were able to meet face to face, and certainly, what happened to Thomas Drake?
Sure.
The way that
we
he
have,
was...
So this, Hope is actually kind of hitting the espionage trifecta, I call it. We're going to have three whistleblowers who were charged with espionage by the U.S. government, two of whom the charges were dropped against.
Yeah, and let's hope that we can get to three.
Exactly. Right? That's what we're hoping for.
Well, actually, Ben, I want to ask you about that, because Daniel Ellsberg did, in fact, go to trial.
He did.
And he won. What has changed where he was able to?
Let's actually be really clear about what happened in Daniel Ellsberg's trial. In fact, Daniel Ellsberg was the first person ever to be charged under the Espionage Act for providing information to the press instead of to an enemy. Daniel Ellsberg took the stand in his defense. he was asked by his lawyer, and this had been a rehearsed give and take, why did you do it? Now, the government objected and said it was irrelevant, that his motives had nothing to do with his guilt or innocence. The judge sustained that objection. That testimony was excluded. Now, before this trial could reach its conclusion, the judge dismissed the entire case on the grounds of outrageous government conduct because the Nixon administration had offered the judge the job of FBI director in the middle of the trial in an attempt to influence the outcome. So, in fact, Ellsberg may well have been convicted, but for how outrageously the Nixon administration had behaved in that case. So although that case did go to trial, we have no precedent from it. There was no acquittal. There was no conviction. The charges were dismissed for reasons that were unrelated to the actual specifics of the government's case.
Well, if Daniel Ellsberg did what he did today, do you think it would be monumentally different, what would be facing him?
It's a good question. You know, I mean, one thing that Daniel Ellsberg said to me is that, you know, one difference is that after he turned himself in, he was released on bail. So he spent the 2 years between the time that he turned himself in and the time that the charges were dismissed living freely, speaking at events, being a citizen in the community. If Snowden were in government custody, he would disappear into the same kind of hole that Chelsea Manning did, where there would be, you know, very, very limited contact even with counsel and family, and certainly none with the press and the public. It's a different time in 2014 than it was back in 1970 or 71.
And lots of really huge corn-fed military police around him.
Well, I guess they wouldn't be military police in Snowden's case. He would be in a federal penitentiary rather than a military one. But I think all things considered, I might prefer a military one.
Well, now the other issue, of course, that a lot of people are concerned about is his future in Russia. Is he in danger of being ejected at some point, of having his visa run out?
You know, it's impossible to say anything with absolute certainty. What I can say is that we're very confident that he'll be able to stay there as long as he needs to stay there. And this is based on statements that that high government officials, including the president there, have made, that he's welcome to stay there for as long as he wants to. Again, our hope is that it won't be forever. Our hope is that he can return to the U.S. If that's not possible in the near future, that some other country will see a way to being able to host him, whether it's a country like Iceland or somewhere in Latin America. You know, of course, getting there would be an issue if the U.S. remains opposed to it. But I do think that his situation is stable in Russia. He does have freedom of movement there. As you've seen, he doesn't only criticize the United States. He's actually been quite critical of the Russian surveillance system, too. Wrote an op-ed in The Guardian in which he essentially called Putin a liar for something that he said about surveillance. And in his interview with Brian Williams for NBC, was very critical about Russian censorship laws with respect to social media. So he's living and speaking and moving as freely. Having said that, you know, he doesn't think it's the ideal place for him to be. And you know, we work every day for better outcomes.
Well, and it certainly makes the United States look bad when Russia is the one keeping somebody, a whistleblower, free from prosecution like this.
I think so. I do hope that people can separate the issue of asylum from the actions of a government. You know, keep in mind that in 2002, 2003, 2004, many thousands of people sought and received asylum in the United States because they were fleeing persecution and torture in their home countries. Most of them did not then, you know, go out and say, I won't be in America because of Abu Ghraib or because of the CIA's rendition program and the black sites. They said, I'm glad to be here because I'm safe and I'm free from persecution in my own country. So, I do think that I understand the irony of someone who is anti-surveillance, pro-liberty, being housed in a regime like that, and how the optics of that must seem to many people, but at the same time, people who come to the U.S. fleeing persecution are not endorsing the U.S.'s drone strikes abroad when they come here seeking refuge.
Wow,
I think the paradoxical nature of that actually speaks to the complexity of the situation in general.
Yeah, I think so. I really do. I mean, I think, you know, the other thing is that, in no way is he suggesting that Russia's system is on par with or you know, let alone superior to ours. His message is these are the reform steps that we need to take if we want to preserve our free societies. And again, the fact that he has to deliver that message from where he is one of those historical and political ironies, but that's all it is.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's a part of that awareness. Like, people need to hear that, yeah, things are not always what they seem, even at home. And that, I think, is the big message and what has propelled the larger discussion in our mainstream and the mainstream around the world.
Well, it's one of those things that people don't want to hear that happens to be
right.
The truth.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We have a very hard time seeing ourselves the way others see us. We really do. I think this is true in many countries, but it's certainly true here. We're raised to think that America is special, and it is in many, many ways. But certainly the way that it has acted abroad in the last decade and a half has been absolutely atrocious. I mean, we've been really one of the world's human rights offenders. And that's why, I mean, I hear people demanding that the rule of law be followed, that he come back and face the music. These are the same people who authorized torture, who set up secret prisons, or who enabled that, or who defended that. How many people who were involved in the torture, including the torture to death, of prisoners during the Bush administration have been prosecuted for that? Certainly no senior official has. And these are the people who are saying right now that, you know, if we don't apply the full force of the law against Edward Snowden, how will we deter future abuses? Well, how are we going to deter future torturers? How are we going to deter future murderers? I take it with a huge grain of salt when I hear the national security priesthood on their high horse about Ed Snowden.
So, Ben, one thing that might deter future leaks of this nature is a robust protections for whistleblowing internally. And we've heard people say that Snowden should have tried to contact the NSA Inspector General or something. What do you make of that suggestion? I think your laughter gives the answer, but do you think there's any hope for progress on that front?
Well, listen, I have lots of hope. I always have lots of hope. Whether I think that there are short-term realistic prospects is a different question. I also think that people misapprehend what it is that Snowden did. You know, there are times when whistleblower, and maybe Thomas Drake is a good example of this, encounters something that is, you know, clearly fraud, waste, abuse, illegal misconduct, you know, something that may not be known to everybody in the oversight community. And in those cases, we can talk about what protections could be put in place for someone like that to be able to go to Congress without fear of being charged under the Espionage Act. You know, what Snowden encountered something quite different. It wasn't some isolated incident of fraud or waste or abuse or illegality. It was an entire regime of surveillance that had been promulgated and approved in secret, and that was known to the oversight mechanisms, had been approved by the secret Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, had been briefed to the Congress's intelligence committees. What was he supposed to do? Call up the Senate Intelligence Committee and say, hello, you know, I'm a 29-year-old contractor, and I'm calling to report to you about programs that you've approved in secret. The problem wasn't that they didn't know. The problem was that they did know and hadn't done anything about it. What was necessary for Snowden was not to alert a judge or a member of Congress, but to bring the public into the debate. And isn't it remarkable what happens when the public is brought in? You know, now these programs that were approved in secret are being questioned by all three branches of government. You now have judges who are for the first time questioning the legality of these programs. You have historic bipartisan legislation in both houses of Congress that would reform these practices. And even the president has appointed review panels that have concluded that the NSA was out of control. So I don't think that there is a tweak in the whistleblower laws that would wholly protect someone like Edward Snowden. I think that he is this is a very singular case. It's why I think that pardon or amnesty or clemency would be appropriate here. What he did is, ironically, go outside the system in order to revitalize the system. You know, we now have some of the most energetic oversight from the courts and Congress that we've seen, you know, in a generation. And it took somebody to break the law in order to vindicate the law. So we certainly need more robust protections for whistleblowers. I'm not sure any of the proposals out there would wholly protect an Edward Snowden. I think this is one of those times where, you know, we need to exercise the discretion to understand that what he did was important and to give him amnesty.
So where does this leave, say, a whistleblower today? Say someone listening to this right now is sitting on something. They want to blow a whistle on it, but they see what happens to Private Manning, to Edward Snowden. What should they do now?
What they should do is really a question of their own, for their own conscience. I will say this. Our democracy has always depended on unauthorized disclosures to the press. All the things that I've been talking about over the last half an hour, torture at Abu Ghraib, the CIA's black site, NSA surveillance, none of these things would be known to the public if everyone inside the system had respected the classification system and had not shared information without permission with the press. Having said that, it's a tremendous risk to do what Snowden did, to do what Manning did, to do what Ellsberg did. And probably people need to be prepared for the possibility that the consequences will be, very, very dire. Now, for most people, no criminal prosecution threat is even necessary. Most people who are in the system understand that if they lose their security clearance, they won't ever be able to work in their field again. They might lose not just their job, but their social connections, in some cases their families. It's very, very hard for people to do what these people do. And I can't, sitting where I sit, tell anybody that it's their obligation to give up their own life in exchange for this kind of principle. I think that what we can do, what Freedom of the Press Foundation can do, what other organizations like that can do, is they can try to make it safer for people to share information with the press without detection. But everyone has to make that risk determination for himself or for herself.
We're speaking with Ben Wisner, Edward Snowden's attorney. And Ben, I just wanted to ask you, there has been some criticism of the way in which these leaks are being released by journalists. Some people want them all at once. They want everything. What do you say to people like
that?
Well,
I think it's a valid opinion. It's not the way Snowden wanted the journalists to do it. My own view is that it would be a worse way for the information to be communicated. Remember, we're not talking about a series of memos that say, from Keith Alexander to NSA employees, with clear instructions about what they should do or even court orders. We're talking about very, very complex and technical documents, PowerPoint presentations, things that, I've discussed this with Bart Gellman from The Washington Post. You know, he wrote a story about an NSA program called Muscular, in which NSA was, essentially breaking into transmissions between Google and Yahoo's data centers overseas and finding the weak points where data was not encrypted and siphoning it off. There was no document, he said, that laid out what it was that the NSA was doing. It was 15 different documents as well as a bunch of other reporting, talking to people in tech companies, talking to people in governments that allowed him and the technologist that he was working with, Ashkan Soltani, to piece together what that program was. It's very, very difficult stuff. In order to figure out what it is and then translate it to a general public, it really requires a lot of work and care. And, I think that there are certainly things in the documents that were necessary for context for the journalist that shouldn't be published. So, for example, Bart Gellman wrote a story in The Washington Post over the weekend about how much so-called incidental collection takes place during surveillance. He had access to 160,000, private emails that had been sucked up by the NSA. Do people really think that those email addresses and those emails should just be published? without redactions, that all of that private information that the NSA probably shouldn't have had in the first place should be dumped on the public. You know, my view is that balancing the public's right to know with the privacy rights of the people whose names are in those documents is a delicate task and is something that takes a lot of time. Now, I wish that the organizations that were doing the journalism on this, Glenn Greenwald's organization, The Washington Post, The New York Times, The Guardian, and others,
they're all coming to Hope, by the way.
I wish they all had more resources. I wish they all had more reporters who could do this. I wish they could work through this stuff with greater speed. And I think that the journalists who are working on this are sensitive to those critiques and would like to get these stories reported faster. I agree with their view that it would not serve the public interest if they simply dumped all this information online.
But I think your point to do it sloppily and hastily would draw away from the actual revelations and constructions of what these different programs are that the journalists do. If they are careless in any way, then what they've actually built to present to the public about the institution is kind of lost, and then maybe other entities or the government themselves maybe come in and point or shine a brighter light on the way it was handled versus the actual point of
I think it could be a distraction, but I also think that there is a role for people who are very impatient about the pace of disclosures to play right now. We've now had the publication of hundreds of documents. Some of them are very, very complex.
Uh-huh.
A lot of the stories that have been written about them, were written hastily in the beginning. I think that there is more crowdsourced intelligence that could be brought to the documents that have already been published, rather than just clamoring for the next one. Go back, dig more deeply into the documents that describe X-Key Score, that describe Bull Run, that describe Muscular, that describe all of these NSA and GCHQ programs that are quite technically complex. I'm sure there are people in our community who could bring and shed more light on this by going back over what's already been published. I don't mean the articles. I mean the documents themselves and seeing if they can illuminate that.
Yeah, I'd like to draw kind of a strange parallel to this. People today with their MP3 devices and access to everything all at once are able to instantly download, say, a library of an entire musician or a band or whatnot, and they can listen to everything in one day, as opposed to the way it originally came out, which was separated by however many months or years, where they had a chance to actually appreciate the music, analyze it, look forward to the next one, not comparing Edward Snowden's releases to rock albums, but what you say about actually reading them and paying attention to them, I think that would be lost if they were all just dumped on us at once. We would tend not to.
Don't you remember how exciting it was when a new record used to come out?
Absolutely.
It's the right pace.
I was growing up in the 70s and 80s. It was like the best thing when somebody's new album would come out.
Yeah, you'd be waiting for it. If you knew that there was going to be a new Snowden document next Tuesday, that gives you something to look forward to. But not to make light of it, because these are really serious issues that
are, and I also just want to make clear that the pace of this, although Snowden gave general instructions to journalists about how he would like to see them apply their craft, he has nothing to do with the pace of disclosures. He gave things to journalists all at once. They're making the decisions about when things will be published and what will be published. He's not pulling the strings. It doesn't mean that he's not involved in some of the stories. I mean, for some of these, because the information is so complex, the reporters rely on him as an expert to explain what some of the documents mean. And so he has been in touch fairly regularly with some of the journalists in that role. But he is not sitting there doling these out. Those decisions are being made by reporters and news organizations.
And he's not in the streets of Moscow handing out state secrets like candy to children.
No, and the U.S. government knows that. For all of their public statements, the U.S. government is still awfully good at intelligence. They still have incredible signals intelligence. They still have a lot of human sources, and the U.S. government knows full well that Russia and China are not in possession of the information that Snowden gave to journalists, and they know it in a thousand ways.
We've talked about the evolution of public opinion and political action, which I'm not sure how sincere the political action actually is. But what about mass media? Have you seen that evolve in their coverage over the last year?
I think so. I mean, I've been saying this, and I wonder if you guys agree, that I think this has been an amazing year for journalism. I think a lot of the credit goes to Glenn Greenwald because he was so aggressive, so fearless, showed such appropriate scorn and derision for the overbroad claims of the national security state, that he essentially forced all of these other news organizations to change their game. Remember in 2004, the New York Times sat on a critical NSA story for 14 months about how the NSA had essentially disregarded the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and was doing massive spying on American citizens without any warrants whatsoever or any grant of authority from Congress.
And New York Times probably through an election as well.
Yeah, they probably never would have published it except that one of the authors, James Risen, was about to publish it in a book, and that forced the New York Times.
After the election.
After Bush was reelected.
Yes. That's a good
point. No, I mean Snowden had that in mind when he chose Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras instead of James Risen, not because he didn't trust James Risen. James Risen is a remarkable and courageous journalist who's willing to risk going to prison to do his work, but because he didn't trust the New York Times. But then a funny thing happened. The Guardian and the Washington Post, essentially pushed the New York Times to try to get in on the game, and they got their hands on documents from the Guardian, and they've done some fairly aggressive reporting on this too. And I think in general, it sort of pierced this bubble. I was talking about a related phenomenon earlier. I think that, so often with these stories, the government goes to news organizations and says, "Do you want to be solely responsible for, killing thousands of women and children by publishing this story?" You have to have a lot of guts as a news organization to disregard that kind of warning coming from security officials. But I think that the government cried wolf one too many times. And just seeing, Greenwald and The Guardian and now The Intercept being so aggressive has, I think, given more muscle, more courage to other news organizations.
So in addition to basically encouraging people to speak the truth and to be whistleblowers whenever possible, Edward Snowden has, in effect, rejuvenated journalism.
Isn't that something?
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah, and I mean, we're now seeing new news organizations come into being because of the Snowden revelations, and who knows what the future of First Look will be. They certainly have the resources and the talent to be a permanent fixture.
Yeah, can you tell us something about that?
Say it again?
Can you tell us something about that?
Yeah, so First Look is a new media organization that is underwritten by the eBay billionaire Pierre Omidyar. Omidyar essentially was so impressed by the Snowden revelations and by Greenwald's journalism that he got together with Greenwald and Poitras and Jeremy Scahill, another excellent investigative reporter, and they came up with a plan to create a new online journalism entity. So far it's only launched partially, a part called The Intercept, which was created so that some of the Snowden documents could be reported on. But I think that they have a plan to really build it out.
And they're coming to Hope as well.
Say it again?
They're coming to Hope.
Bernie, who isn't coming to Hope? I mean, literally,
those,
the last hour...
They just listed a bunch of just been listing really all renowned these news organizations a minute ago. Every one of them is coming to Hope.
Can we all get a bigger hotel?
What's that?
The hotel, yeah.
Yeah.
We're going to outgrow that hotel. We're going to need a bigger one for the next Hope.
Yeah, we're going to be spilling out onto 7th Avenue. There's no question about that.
Maybe we can take over Madison Square Garden across the street.
We might have
to. And Michael Lee from First Look is coming.
Great. Yeah, Michael Lee is another one of these terrific public interest technologists who's doing a lot of critical work on security to make it safer for investigative journalists to communicate with sources.
And one of the reporters that Ed Snowden leaked documents to is also coming. Is that correct, Bernie?
Mark Elman.
Okay, from the Washington Post.
Oh, that's terrific. Yeah.
I mean, we have a laundry list of some highly renowned journalists, world-renowned journalists, first-class journalists coming to HopeX. This is going to be covered better than all the other Hope conferences combined. So
it's sold out, isn't it?
Not yet, but it's going to be.
Are you kidding?
I don't know when sold out actually is. We have to basically come up with a number and decide.
Is it possible that there's anybody listening to this show who hasn't bought a ticket yet?
Yeah, it's possible because the show gets passed around. Hope.net is the website. And yeah, you know, next week we will definitely have pre-registration closed, but we might have to close it a lot earlier if things keep going the way they're going.
Yeah.
I'll
so
tell you what,
if you're listening now or if you listen to it as a podcast or whatever, get online now and buy a ticket, if only to see the historic conversation between Ed Snowden and Dan Ellsberg. But there's a lot of other incredible stuff going on there.
I'll tell you what we are out of, though, is the press passes. I think we no longer can grant admission to journalists. So,
yeah, it got a little out of hand. Every journalist in the world seemed to want to.
So journalists can come, can still come to the conference, but they have to get a ticket.
And we should also point out, and I think this is important, that Ed Snowden will be speaking with Daniel Ellsberg. Ben, maybe we should talk just for a second about what this will not be. This will not be a press conference where a journalist will be shouting questions over to Moscow or wherever Snowden actually is. This is a conference for our attendees, and they're here to listen, to learn. And if anyone asks questions, they would be the first ones to be able to do that.
So. I think that's right. And I do think that. You know, this is an amazing opportunity to hear these two people interact with each other. I think parts of the format may still be up in the air a little bit, but as you said, the point here is not for reporters to stand in the front row and to fire questions at Ed Snowden. That's not what he hopes to get out of this. He's hoping for a very elevated and high-minded conversation, and he chose the Hope community. Because it's really his people, people who combine technical savvy with principle. People who think that this isn't all a game, technology, but it's something that is really tied to our future and to our liberty, and needs to be used in the right way and not the wrong way.
Well, Ben Wiesner, this hour has shot by. You're originally just supposed to be on for a half hour, but wow. So much to talk about here. We could keep going. Final question. What can people do to help with Ed Snowden? And any contact info you want to give out?
Well, if people want to contribute to a defense fund, some of the lawyers, and of course the ACLU's representation of Snowden is without charge. We don't charge clients. But there are lawyers on the team who aren't able to participate that way, criminal lawyers, lawyers in Europe. And so there is a new website, edwardsnowden.com, where people can make contributions to the defense fund. But I think more important than contributing to his defense fund is being engaged. What Snowden said a year ago is that his biggest fear was that he had taken all this risk for nothing, was that people would receive this information and that they would yawn and that they would move on. Now, I think that didn't happen. the opposite has happened. We've seen this remarkable global debate, but it's not something that people can be passive about. People need to be very engaged citizens, and in whatever way that, whatever shape or form that takes for them, whether it is doing online activism, whether it is being in touch with members of Congress, I think there are a lot of ways for people to be involved.
Okay, thank you so much, Ben, for all you've done, and we definitely look forward to Saturday the 19th, Ed Snowden speaking at the Hope Conference. Again, hope.net for more information on that. Write to us, oth@2600.com, if you have any feedback on Off the Hook. We will see you again next week. Have a good night.